Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. Bill Doan is a professor of theater at Penn State. The university selected Doan to be the 2019-20 Penn State Laureate, a role that spotlights the arts and humanities. For Doan, that means performances, drawings, and talks focused on anxiety and depression and how art, science, and health can work together. In doing so, Doan shares his own struggles with anxiety, depression, and loss. Bill Doan, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're a theater professor, but a lot of your work being featured as part of this is drawings and illustrations. I read that you started drawing as a child. Is that right?
Yeah, I have really been drawing my whole life. It was much later in life when I figured out that drawing was helping me, that it was therapeutic. I just did it. But it was, when I look back, it was always when I was overwhelmed, I would go to my room and I would draw in journals and doodle and margins of whatever I was doing. And it was sort of helping me deal and helping me make meaning out of what was happening.
But you decided to go in the direction of theater rather than drawing.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I didn't go the typical route to theater. Like, I never really intended to be an actor, even though I had done acting and studied some acting. I always thought I would make original theater works. I mean, as a director and as a designer and as kind of like a, just render my own vision of stuff onto the stage. So for me, the link between the drawing and the theatrical kind of genre seemed natural because I made a lot of experimental work. I made a lot of solo work. And that work always included me doing the drawing or the painting or the scenic design. So there was always that connection for me.
You were the creator, the director behind the scenes. And just to give an idea of what some of your art looks like, so it looks like a lot of pen and ink and watercolor with the written narrative. Is that right?
Yeah, it's I mostly work entirely in ink and watercolor washes. And every once in a while, I'll use what are called watercolor crayons. They're a thicker, and you can still water them down, but you get sort of a more intense pigment out of them. And it's almost entirely ink washes and watercolor washes.
I don't know why exactly, but it does seem that medium seems fitting for your work. Why are you drawn to doing it that way?
You know, I've always loved the aesthetic of ink drawings, always, since I was a little kid. Not so much like even the comic book style of inking. It was more, I've always been fascinated with Japanese ink art, grinding your own ink and brush calligraphy and brush painting, seeing it move, the ink move in the water and the wetness. So I've just always been drawn to that aesthetic, and it seemed for the kinds of stories I wanted to tell, it always felt like that worked for me. And then actually along the way, I've studied with a few ink masters who even once I was doing a residency in Japan and studied for a month with Asumi ink artist, and that technique has just always been what speaks to me.
Looking at your drawings, to give people an idea of what they look like, there's one drawing that I came across, and it looks like a man, and I don't know, maybe it's you, and he's kind of awkwardly taking his shirt off, and then this the script, the writing on the side says, sharing what it's like to live with anxiety and depression is a lot like undressing in front of strangers. It's awkward.
Yeah.
How do these pieces come to be?
That's actually, there's a series of, I don't know, did you see all three of them?
I think so.
Various stages of undress. one day, actually, I was thinking about what this feels like to talk about anxiety and depression. I did a whole series of drawings called This Is What Depression Feels Like, where I was trying to capture the emotional experience of depression. But I hadn't really thought about what's it feel like to tell this story? And that image struck me of, it's kind of like getting naked in front of people, baring your soul. So I just started sketching out myself, pulling my shirt off in various stages. And after I had about two or three of them, I thought, oh, that's a nifty little comic, actually. It works, as a kind of self-contained set of drawings.
Yeah. Does it help kind of unburden yourself mentally? Like you were saying that as a child, that's why you were drawing.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I actually draw as a form of meditation. I mean, every day. My meditation practice is rooted in drawing. So it kind of evolved to that over time because the practice of drawing, I discovered, slows down my breathing, especially if I'm dealing with anxiety or feeling like an anxiety attack may be coming on. It's a grounding exercise for me. As soon as I take that pen and start working the paper, I get focused. I notice that my breathing slows, my heart rate slows, and over time I notice that the practice just also seemed to have a positive effect on my brain, that I could literally feel good things happening in my brain. So I just deepened that practice over time. And now it's the primary way I use to sort of calm myself and ground myself.
That's so interesting. I don't think a lot of people would normally think about like drawing as a form of meditation. You think of maybe doing, you know, traditional meditation or yoga, but it's, yeah. I guess I could see that getting lost in it.
Yeah. I read a lot about walking meditation because I tried sitting meditation. No, I think I'm borderline ADHD, so it was like, I just knew that wasn't going to work for me. And as I was reading about walking meditation, particularly Thich Nhat Hanh writes about doing anything can be meditation, washing the dishes, cleaning. And so I started to think about that kind of active meditation and then started to practice drawing as my way of doing that.
Your work has been featured in the Annals of Internal Medicine's mm-hmm. Graphic Medicine.
Right.
There's one that you did. It's called, Is This What Depression Looks Like? And I wondered if you could read part of that for us.
Yeah, sure. This was, I think, maybe the second piece I published with them. And interestingly, quickly, I'll tell you that the editor, before they would publish this, emailed me and asked me if I was okay. Because he's a physician and they wanted to make sure that there wasn't like suicidal ideation or something. And I said, yeah, I'm okay. I'm really trying to show people what this feels like. And I appreciated the fact that he checked in with me, right? So here it is. I can't remember a time when I wasn't afraid, angry, or sad, or a time when my brain wasn't like a firework display on the 4th of July with endless explosions of color and sound and movement, which is great if it isn't happening all the time. And I mean all the time, over and over and over and over. My brain on fire, the amygdala, the thalamus, the hippocampus disrupting sleep. Sometimes my eyelids are so unbelievably heavy, and closing them can help calm my brain, if only for a minute, a melancholy pause, a moment when the system balances. Is this the black dog of depression I've read about? Are there genes turning on and off? Are some neurons not firing? Is my type 2 diabetes at fault? Will I ever wake up happy? The little boy, my little self, is ready for some new reality.
Yeah, thank you. That's so, it's so moving.
Thanks.
It seems like it gives people an idea, kind of a window into what that's like. But then it also raises the questions about why is this happening? Why does this happen to some people, not everybody?
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're any closer to getting those answers?
I am, in the sense that, you know, I'm 3 years into what I'm calling the Anxiety Project, right? So there's over 500 drawings in the project now. There's three different performance pieces and then this series of publications. So it's a fairly large body of work. And I'm closer to understanding the fact that we need to approach particularly anxiety and depression, probably all mental health issues, as complex problems and stop looking for simple answers and silver bullets. Like even medication is only one part of my regimen of therapy. And so, yes, understanding the complexity of it, that it's likely to be partially genetic. It's also socioeconomic status and class and the way I grew up. It's the type 2 diabetes. It's childhood trauma. It's if you don't take into consideration all of those things and try to accept and understand them, then I just think you're walking down the wrong road. If you're looking for even someone, let's say, with bipolar disorder 1 or those, you know, might be a little clearer in terms of diagnosis, genetic or what's happening in the brain. But anxiety disorders and depressive disorders are very complicated and include the social as well as the biomedical.
So you're dealing with anxiety, but how did you get past that and the embarrassment of talking about these things in something so personal in such a public way?
You know, I think that's why I started drawing first. Before I ever did performances, I was putting the drawings out into the world because I was a little protected, right? Whether it's in the Annals of Internal Medicine or in an exhibition and I'm not there front and center, I could start to sort of speak about this without directly speaking about it, right? And then I slowly eased myself toward these performances with the drawings. And they were very difficult at first. Like on the first night that I did one in New York City at the Dixon Place Theater, if I hadn't had Tyler Sparaza, who was my lighting designer and was doing the show with me, and a couple of other good friends there to make sure I went on, I think I would have just ran out of the theater and that would have been it. But what I discovered, and this is, to me, this is potential research that I'd love to find someone to do this with, that as I was performing and telling the story, like the drawing, I suddenly started to feel things change in my body. And it felt like, first of all, there was relief at not hiding and not just letting it build up as anger. So there was a certain amount of relief at finally telling the story. I think I was a smart enough and sophisticated enough theater artist to understand that I had to have some humor in there, or, you know, people were just going to be like, you know, devastated by this. And I was getting laughs when I should get laughs, but I was also getting the oohs and ahs. And so I thought, you know, this is like drawing. When it works, I feel like physiological things happen that are good. And I felt chemical things happening in my brain, like serotonin level or whatever it is and was. It was actually improving my mood to do this. So despite the anxiety, I kept focusing on the fact that it has a therapeutic effect.
That's so interesting that it's kind of liberating, because for a lot of people, even if you're not doing a theater performance, just public speaking can be so anxiety producing. Yeah. So it's kind of ironic in a way that dealing with all this anxiety in such a public way through theater and presentation.
You know, there is always that moment of, why am I doing this, right? But I've also, I think, through the meditation practice and the other things that I do, breathing, I know that when that's coming, that I can manage it if I pay attention to it.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. We're talking with Bill Doan, professor of theater and this year's Penn State laureate. You struggled with these issues your whole life, but it's only been in the recent years that you've been kind of talking about them and dealing with them. And I hope this isn't too personal. I read that this started to happen after your sister was in a very serious car crash in 2012. And eventually the family decided to end life support. And it sounds like it was just extremely traumatic. Did that kind of open it so that you felt like I have to deal with this?
I'm pretty sure it did, in the sense that I have had anxiety and depression issues, like I said, since I was a kid. But I always found ways to either manage it or hide it or mask it. Some things that weren't very good, but they work, right? You bury it, you deflect, you know. I'd been in and out of therapy a few times. I did what a lot of people do. I worked, you know, as many hours a week as I possibly could to stay on the run from it. But yeah, in 2012, my sister was in a car accident, suffered a severe traumatic brain injury. She was 40 at the time and a single mother of 2 children. She never woke up. She was in a persistent vegetative state for 2 years when we made the decision to withdraw her from life support and let her go. during that 2 years, I drew her and sort of archived her march toward death. The original drawings of this beautiful 40-year-old woman, the final drawings of a 68-pound, you know, essentially a corpse. I made a show about that that I did at Hershey Medical and other hospitals about end-of-life decision-making. And as part of that, my anxiety and depression sort of came back stronger than it had been in a long time. And I started the anxiety project as a way of trying to deal with it, and then discovered, well, that just wasn't going to be enough. And that if I didn't do something, I was headed for some kind of a crisis. And in fact, that oddly, that's when I finally had to start telling the whole truth, even to my wife and my daughter. They knew bits and pieces of it. But even sort of starting to come clean had to happen when it happened.
So even your family, people you were close to, didn't really understand the full extent of what you were experiencing. Why do you think that is, that you and other people who are going through this also a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times feel this need or feel the stigma associated with this, or this need to kind of try to hide it or pretend it's not happening?
Yeah, certainly the stigma around mental health is really dangerous and risky. I think in some ways I see that lifting these days. But, you know, as a person who's 60, when I first started experiencing these things 45, 50 years ago almost, it was a different world, right? I mean, you didn't go to therapy. First of all, I was from a poor working class family, and it's not like you had a therapist or had health insurance that would include that, right? It was, no, you need to go talk to the priest, right? Or suck it up and move on, right? I mean, yeah, the world sucks. Everybody's sad. I mean, and that's not a criticism of my family. That's just the way it was. And so, you know, you learn how to shove it down, how to mask it, how to hide it. And we're incredibly good at that. And I think at the end of the day, even if your friends and others close to you see it, and even if they have a split second thought of, you know, I wonder if he has a mental illness, none of us wants to admit that about someone we know and love. And so I think we immediately go, nah, he'll be all right. It's just this weird dance we do with it. And it allows people to hide it.
What was the response you got from your family, your friends, your colleagues? I'm wondering, too, if there was some relief on their end, too. Like, oh, gosh, okay, we can finally talk about this.
Yeah, I think in some ways. Like, first, my mom really struggled with it at first because as a parent, I think immediately she thought, oh, my God, did I do this to him, or did the circumstances of our life do this to him? And, you know, I do have a slide in my show with a Freud joke about if it's not one thing, it's your mother. And I always have to apologize to my mother for that. But I think as we talked through it, even with my siblings, I think who I was started to make more sense to them, because I was very different from my other three siblings. And so I think in some ways there was this, oh, okay, yeah, I guess that does make sense, even though initially there was some, oh, come on, you're not, you know, everybody's anxious. Everybody gets depressed. And I said, yeah, to some degree, we all experience anxiety and we all experience sadness. But there are diagnosable conditions that are more than what the average human being experiences. So getting us all to kind of get around the same table with that took a while.
You said you think the taboo is going away somewhat around these issues?
I think it's lifting in the sense, particularly with college students. I don't think they're stigma free, but I'm finding that students here at Penn State in particular are way more willing to talk about their anxiety and their depression or their ADHD or their autism if they're somewhere on the spectrum. There's more of an openness and almost an expectation, which I think is really good for them, that they will say, if I share this with you, I expect you to respect it and understand that, you know, that will affect our relationship with each other, right? And so I applaud that. It's like they want you to know who they are up front and deal with them honestly. But I think that particularly with young men, the stigma is still very deep. and because it seems soft, not masculine. So yeah, I think we still have a long ways to go. But there's so much conversation in the air right now. The National Association of Mental Health Institutes, on Twitter and on Instagram, people are talking about mental health way more openly than they used to, maybe in some cases too openly. But I do think that good can come from that.
Do you incorporate what you've learned about your mental health and going through this process? Do you incorporate that all into your teaching?
Absolutely.
How does that work?
Yeah. You know, it's the wonderful thing about teaching, particularly theater, is and art, is that, you know, in the history of art, artists have always been addressing depression, melancholy, fear. I mean, these themes are huge in the history of art. And so I find that I don't have to look very far for a play or a painting or a graphic narrative piece that helps me engage students around these questions and to engage them around them aesthetically. Like, what does it look like? And how do we stage that? And how do we engage an audience in that? I think the arts may be one of the easier fields to engage these questions with.
Do you ever use class projects or the work that the students have to do? Do they explore these issues at all?
In at least one of my classes, it's a contemporary theater class, an experimental theater class that I've taught a few times. And the students get to do what I call an autoethnographic project, where they tell their story, but they have to tell it in the context of a larger story. So if you feel the key to your story is that you're a woman, then you have to tell your story in the context of feminist history or feminist literature, if it's race or so, whatever it is. And a lot of them choose to talk about their mental health issues in that larger social context. And actually, the project, they make a sort of a little performance out of it. And it's, for me, it's not only teaching them something about dramatic structure and performative structure, but it's giving them sort of a way to refine telling their own story. Because once they leave college and they're starting to make their way through life in the world and in the job market, telling your story is something you kind of never stop doing, and you need to be really good at it.
Right. So a skill for them too. Are there any stories from students that stand out that you can share?
Oh gosh, there's been so many. I had an undergraduate student who had lost a parent very early in life to cancer, her mother to cancer. And she was, you know, trying to struggle with what that meant to her as now a young adult and as someone who was also going to probably have to be tested to see if the, you know, if it was a genetic. So she made a piece about confronting not just the loss, but the fear of what that loss might mean to the future of her own life. Brilliant performance piece. Yeah, there have been a number of those.
So kind of on the other side of that, one of the criticisms of culture and higher ed in particular is that students are coddled, and I'm using air quotes, and that, they're snowflakes.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, how do you see that criticism, particularly in light of what we've just been talking about, the idea of trying to get past the stigma of dealing with a lot of these issues?
Yeah, it is possible to coddle someone too much, right? Or to not make them responsible for their actions. We've seen that happen. But frankly, I think most of that is a load of crap being peddled by people who want to continue to push us beyond what we may be capable of, because we live in a culture that is driven by you're only as good as your last painting, your last project, your last book, your last film, your last radio show. You have to keep topping yourself if you want to be on top, if you want to win, if you want, you know. And I think that's where a lot of that criticism comes from, that if we allow people moments of softness, moments of self-reflection where they might care for themselves and grow, that we're somehow, you know, making them inferior human beings. I struggle with the other scenario of being so demanding that students can never sort of celebrate the satisfaction of what they have created or succeeded in, that they have to immediately throw that away and go on to the next thing and try to make it better. I reject that completely.
You were also an artist in residence in the College of Nursing
Yes.
this past year, and part of that was creating performance art, exploring palliative care, so care for aimed at providing relief and easing the pain for someone with a serious illness. How did you go about doing that?
Yeah, this is my second year as the artist residence there. And that was part of the first year and part of this year. That was surrounded by the project about my sister called Drifting, where I would share the drawings and the process and the performance piece about how my family made that decision, what were the factors involved, the fact that we're Irish, Italian, Catholic. And so that was a lot of the first year in residency there and at Hershey Medical, the Kindly Center for the Humanistic Study of Medicine. I worked down there with some physicians that were doing research on end-of-life decision-making and how people do that, sharing that story, sharing the drawings. And now this year, in addition to the anxiety project, I still visit. There's a nursing course called Dying and Death, where I go and share that work and talk to them about how people make these decisions and what it mean, what your religion, what your faith might play in that decision, whether or not you have health insurance might play in that decision, and try to engage them out of my own experience with those bigger questions.
So we've been talking a little bit about the anxiety project, your big project at Penn State, and also the work with the College of Nursing. Overall, what do you hope people take away from it?
Oh, gosh, that's such a good question. Hard to answer because you don't want to sound cheesy, you know, but like I say at the end of the talk, it's a little bit about fighting stigma. And it's a little bit about standing up to, you know, a society that wants to dehumanize people. So it's a little bit about those things. But it's really about understanding. I think if people can understand, literally comprehend how crushing anxiety and depression can be, it will make them more empathetic. It will make them more aware of what's happening in the people around them. It will connect them more compassionately to the world they live in. So I'm really trying to help people understand that, you know, what is this? And what does it really do to a person? And what can you do to just offer that person a little bit of empathy and compassion?
And you've said that you spent a big part of your life in fight or flight mode and that you're developing, you have a variety of different strategies, different techniques for coping with it. Do you feel like you are in a better place with it now?
Much better. You know, again, I suspect that I will live to some degree with anxiety and depression my whole life. Maybe I'll wake up one morning and they'll be gone. But hey, I'm 60. They haven't gone away so far. But this process and in being in therapy, I don't want to underestimate that. With a therapist that I trusted deeply and another one of the processes that I just think if you need to be in therapy, you need to be in therapy, right? So yes, I feel finally that I can live with my anxiety and depression, not in spite of them, not because of them, not trying to run away from them, but that they're there. Some days they're there more, it's more prevalent than others. Some days it's blessedly hardly there at all. And, you know, and I'm deeply grateful to have kind of arrived at that place.
Bill Doan, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you. It was great. I appreciate your time, too.
We've been talking with Bill Doan, a professor of theater and this year's Penn State laureate. To hear this and other episodes of Take Note, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.